On the line, we have Holly Smith. Kia ora, Holly.
Kia ora, Shane. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for being here. Holly, I love the new album. We're going to talk about that in a minute. I've been listening to it all week, and I find some of the songs very meaningful, particularly at a time where life is a little bit tough. And, you know, what I like about a song, if it sort of reaches you and you can personalize it, and there are a couple of songs on that album that certainly have done that for me, and I want to talk about that as we get into this kōrero. But Holly, what I want to do to start off with is I want to ask you who your early music influences were, both within Aotearoa and externally, because you started singing and producing albums quite early, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I mean, it's kind of, I definitely always had a thing for music since, you know, as long as I can remember. My mum can certainly vouch for that. But I mean, I kind of just got obsessed with things. Like, it was the sound of music. But then I found a videotape that my mum and dad had recorded on VCR of James Brown.
Nice.
And En Vogue had opened for them.
Mm.
So, and it was, you know, and the BV singers, it was like, you know, this beautiful big black woman. She does this massive solo, and it was like, oh, I'm going to be a big black soul singer.
Nice.
When I grow up. And I was like, okay, one out of three ain't bad. But, yeah, it was, I mean, I was obsessed with James Brown. It was, my first cassette tape was Kylie Minogue, because probably everyone in my age was.
Of course.
But, you know, but, but had a really strong affinity to soul music and blues and particularly American, black music, which has always played a pretty significant role in my journey. I mean, obviously, Annie Crummer with, her belting sounds.
Yes.
And, you know, it's been crazy to even, you know, sort of now have covered, that particular track that everyone knows, and to for her to be that I can call a friend is amazing.
Fantastic.
Adore that woman. So yeah, but still had very, very vast musical tastes from a young age, and just focused on all of them really moving forward.
Because your first album, produced one by a whānau member, was Celtic Music, if I remember correctly.
That is correct.
Yeah,
Steve McDonald. So he's my stepfather.
Yeah.
He came into the picture probably when I was about 9 or 10. And he was just sort of starting his Celtic, he'd done music forever. He's an incredible, incredible dude. He demonstrated for Roland all through Japan and things when it came out. He was sort of the first sort of synthesized one-man band kind of vibe.
Mm-hmm.
So he was on the circuit in Australia, opening for Midnight Oil and Jimmy Barnes, because they could just roll him out and he'd play this epic set on his own and then roll him back off. And pretty amazing. But he started focusing on his whakapapa, back to his Celtic Scottish roots, and all of his albums are stories from his ancestry. So he became quite a big Celtic artist in the States, where there's a big sort of new age movement, and in Scotland. I sang a single on one of his albums, and the record label in Colorado, Ethereum Music, really loved it and asked me to be, they basically said, you want to be the new modern face of Celtic music?
Nice.
And I was like, not really.
No.
I hate it at that point. But, you know, mum did some pretty good bribery. And I got to go to the big day out with my big sister, much to her disgust. But
who was the headline act? Can you remember?
I think it might have been Rage Against the Machine.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
It was a while ago. But basically, they bribed me to do this album. And then me and Steve toured the States when I was about 16, 17. I opened for him, but we had the same band. And that actually led me to go back over to the States and record my own music, which was the first of many American failures.
it's a tough gig, that American scene. But didn't one of your songs or a sample from one of your songs get picked up earlier on and by DMX?
Wow, you have done your research. Yes.
It was
a funny way because it was one of Steve's songs, and I was just singing BVs on it. And this is one of the point of sampling, which disappointed me when I found this out, to be fair, because, you know, like, they asked Steve to I mean, at that point, DMX was a multi-million selling American hip-hop artist. And they basically said, oh, we'll give you a 5% mechanical, which is, you know, like 4 cents a song or whatever, to, you know, sample some of your stuff. And he was like, oh, may as well, like, you know, why not? And then I heard it, and it was literally the whole entire track. My voice was pitched up to Chipmunk, and then they had some awesome, like, soul singer singing the same lyrics, but the way that I would have liked to have sung it. And then just a hip-hop beat and him and sing. And it was, and it's a really gorgeous song that he wrote. It still sounds great with DMX's treatment. But
it does. I was listening to it earlier on today. And the interesting thing about all of that is that sampling is huge now. Basically, there are very few songs that the big acts write that don't have some form, particularly hip-hop, that don't have some form of sampling. But sampling wasn't a big thing back then, was it, Ollie?
Well, I think the sampling law system has changed possibly since that situation. I mean, well, yes and maybe no. I mean, I know that his name's slipping my mind off the top of my head, but one of Beyonce's producers was in New Zealand, and we had a workshop with him, and he was saying, you know, some of the songs that, you know, Beyonce have used for her tracks and played the original song. And it is surprisingly much like the original song. Like, you know, there's a lot of credit to be given to the curators of hip-hop that have found incredible music to reuse. But as long as it's done with respect, I'm all about it.
And, of course, there was an extraordinary court case only a few years ago when Robin Thicke came out with Blurred Lines and, you know, basically, I think, anyway, Holly, and actually the court found this way, basically ripped off almost the well, not the entire song, but certainly the backbone of it, and the family were paid millions of dollars as a result of it. So it's almost come full circle where past greats, their legacies are chasing up money, and even some of the smaller acts, when basically their music is used without permission and used without royalties.
Yeah, and it does happen a lot. And a lot of those smaller artists, like, you know, I mean, one of the songs that the producer I was just mentioning, I mean, they'd gone through and they clear everything and they pay them. But then you wonder how much they pay them in regards to, you know, $100,000 check looks pretty great if you haven't seen $50 for 3 weeks. You know, so, I mean, not for me to say, but... Yeah. I mean, they were a small Mexican prog rock band in some small county somewhere. You know, it's that kind of bizarre thing where, you know, it would have been, you know, lotto day for them. But it's strange. It's the same thing with Tom Petty and Sam Smith. Like, Sam Smith, you know, his massive track. And every time I sing it, I can't not then go on to sing Tom Petty. Like, nice. I can't.
Yeah, that's right, because he's in your head, eh?
Like, And I was just going, how is no one hearing this? Like, it's a gorgeous song. He's a wonderful singer. But, like, Tom Petty, anybody? Like, you know, it's just like, when is this going to be a conversation? Like, this is plagiaristic.
Yeah,
to the max.
Plagiaristic.
And it was, I don't know if it was intentional or not, but, you know, at the end of the day, like, they ended up, you know, Tom Petty did receive royalties from it. But, I mean, you know, it's so difficult to write an original song now. I mean, you know, to write something and not assume it's already been done is that's the tricky part. I wrote Thriller when I was 8.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a winner. And then I, you know, realised that it had been done before.
Well, so. I sort of, and I'm certainly not trying to put myself in the same league as you, but I get what you're saying. I often write, and I write and put works together for the New Zealand Herald, and then I read it, and I think, geez, you know, these lines are good, you know, or these lines aren't so good. But then you think, where have I heard this before? Where have I read it before? And sometimes what you do is you just naturally pick up whole pieces of literature or whole lines that you ought not to use, but it's just there, and it often just for me appears appears to me on a piece of paper without any conscious thinking. Does that happen to you as a songwriter, Holly?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the thing. I mean, like you're saying, it's more of a subconscious, you know, saturation. And, you know, like you walk into a, I mean, I don't listen to mainstream music, you know, that much. I try and stay hip by listening to it occasionally. But, you know, like you're going through a supermarket or in the mall or whatever, and, you know, you're hearing these things. And my brain obviously will potentially picks it up in a slightly different manner. But then when I go to write something, like everything just feels really obvious when I'm on the songwriting track. And then all of a sudden you're there going, oh, that's otherwise really, really good. Yeah. Or I've just plagiarized a really good song.
Because, you know, you're renowned as a soul singer. And, you know, I don't want to pigeonhole you, but if I was to ask most people, Holly Smith, how would you describe her music? They would describe you as a soul singer. But you started off with Celtic music, and then you moved into and got some...
To be fair, the Celtic music, just to interrupt, that wasn't
okay.
really...
Yeah.
That wasn't by choice.
Yeah. But, you know, it was great. It was more than a great little start. It was a great start for you. But then you joined up with Warren Rior and Ben from Trinity Roots. How did that come about?
It was around a bonfire, I recall.
Yeah.
So Ricky was the drummer. Ricky Rio, bass, and Warren, who's now a little bushman, Warren Maxwell.
Yeah.
And I think we were sitting around a fight. Me and my partner Nick Gaffney, who was a drummer. I met. He's an amazing drummer. He has played for lots of people in New Zealand. He lives in LA now with his own band. We were sitting around a campfire when we first moved to Wellington, and I started singing. Well, I started harmonising with the song I was singing, and they were just like, what? And so that's what really got me started. Warren really took me under his wing, and, you know, they invited me into their recording session, Homeland, for the album Homeland.
Great album.
And they just offered, you know, they just said, oh, come in and have a listen, you know, and I was like, yeah, awesome. Hadn't really done a studio thing like that before. And went in, was sitting there and just totally loving it. And I was just humming away to myself, you know, little things. And then Warren was like, all right, girl, that's you, off you pop. And I was like, what? He's like, yep, that sounded me. Do what you just did then. That harmonies are all nice. And kind of went in there going, okay. And then the first tour was with, you know, my first national tour was with Trinity Roots doing Homeland and Sea Tour. And possibly one of the most enlightening and beautiful tours I've ever done. It was also the first journey for me into tikanga Māori as well. Like I came from a very white background in Auckland and, you know, always learned a lot and tried to learn, but that was really the first time that I fully understood, you know, what I'd been missing, you know, that lack of education that I couldn't have been taught, but to feel it and to be in marae-style environments and just the love and the aroha that we were given and Warren and those boys were so awesome as well. Like someone would come up to a gig, they'd come at soundcheck and it's like, hey, absolutely no pressure, but we've put a hangi down for you fellas.
Yeah.
We've got a projector screen for the rugby. Nice. You're welcome to come over after, but you know, that's you just do you, that's all good, da da da. And then Warren afterwards would be like, oh, we'll just go to that fella's house, hey. And then we'd just rock up in the tour van.
Nice.
We'll sit around, have a few beers and watch the rugby and have a mean air speed and then so not, like, okay, ka kite.
But not only a way to discover Te Ao Māori, but a great way to discover small town New Zealand, because that tour basically went to not just the big cities or even the bigger towns, but went to some smaller sort of off-road places. And so I would imagine it would have been just a great way to see Aotearoa from a different perspective.
Yeah, no, I travelled a lot as a child. You know, I've always travelled a lot around New Zealand with my mum and whānau, but that was definitely a different experience for me. And also, you know, in an interesting way, like a lot of the people that I was discussing, like, you know, they'd kind of see me prior to a gig and they'd really ignore me hard out. I was the only like white girl hanging out. And then after the show, be like, oh, I'm really sorry, sis. Like, didn't realize you were part of the family. But just also for the first time experiencing, you know, the opposite of what I'd been accustomed to, and learning that understanding as well was a big growth moment for my empathy and understanding, you know, sort of race relations and cultures, and you know, the obviousness that I didn't ever notice or understand before. So it was a huge moment for me, that tour, and it definitely changed my, you know, the pivot of where I continued my empathy journey from that point. Yeah, for sure.
Because you often play just as yourself, or you might, you know, play guest with a band or sing with another singer, but also you've done some pretty big warm-up acts in your career. Bob Dylan, and I stand to be corrected, Coldplay. Tell me something, what is it like playing before the legend, not only the musical legend, but the literary legend, Bob Dylan? And did you get to meet him?
Yeah, Bob Dylan was an interesting one. I mean, that was still one of the most significant openings I've done, and one that I treasure. Bob Dylan works in a really interesting way, and I think that's through years of death threats and crazy, you know, sort of social movements that he's been a part of. But yeah, he I mean, I spent time with his band, and I watched his sound check, and it was at the Civic, and he normally doesn't do shows, you know, smaller than sort of 3,000 people. Yeah. So the Civic was incredibly intimate for that, and amazing sound. So those were incredible shows. You know, watch the sound sheet. I didn't meet him, but no one does. His promoter that had done the Australian and New Zealand tours with him hadn't met him. He's got like a little pyramid of people around him, but hung out with the band, and they're all incredible people, and some have been with him for a long time, some were new, and they just sort of accept his thing. And he has this thing where he, instead of waking up and getting to the next city, he always wants to be in the next city the morning of.
Yes.
So he'll leave the stage and get onto a plane or whatever and go to the next port of call so he can wake up there and acclimatise, I assume.
I've seen him twice, and honestly, the first show I was really disappointed. This was, I think, not the last time he was in Aotearoa, the time before, but the last time I was... He was in Aotearoa, and that was, you know, and he's getting on a bit, and I think it was 4 or 5 years gap in between. It was a sensational show, and because sometimes you get these guys just on a bad day. They might be too tired, or they might just be a bit hoa, or had been upset with somebody, but his last show was just fantastic, and I enjoyed it, and I, you know, and it's one of the bucket lists in terms of music that, you know, that I can tick off, and just watching the literary great and, you know, someone who has had 50 years of continuous influence, not only in terms of the music scene, but in terms of at the forefront of equity issues. You know, he was Black Lives Matter before Black Lives Matter kids were born, you
Absolutely.
Know, before their mums and dads were born, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. So and that's the thing, like, the and that sound created so much trauma for him, but, like, you know, that was a huge part of his development, was being like doing, you know, the arts, My Friend Is Blowing in the Wind, or How Many Roads, and that kind of thing. Like, I mean, he got bombarded with death threats every day for years. Like, he's never stepped away from that. But it was funny because, like, you know, we're in the Civic, we're in this beautiful venue, and the tickets were expensive. And I remember going to the bathroom, and there's all these rich white women, like, washing their hands, going, oh, he just sounds terrible. I mean,
yeah,
and I was like, man, he's never been able to sing.
Yeah.
He's always been a shit guitar player. Like, you're not here for that. Like,
no.
If you're here for a musical, go to the opera or something, man. Like, this isn't, you're here for the wrong reasons if you think that. And the same thing I felt was when I saw B.B. King, who's an absolute idol of mine. You know, he was 86, 87, and he was at the Civic, and all of his girls were in the row, three of his daughters were in the rows, and they were just on their phones the whole time, and they stood up and did a wave at one point. But he would get halfway through a song and just stop and start rambling. Like, he probably did, like, maybe five songs almost and just talk the rest of it. And people were complaining about it. It's like, man, I was in the presence of God tonight. I'm happy. Like, that was, I was like hanging out with my favorite grandfather tonight. And that's, he's 87. Have you ever toured? Do we know how hard touring is?
And like, he was a big man for many years. He could, I had a similar experience. I went all the way to Melbourne to watch Barry White. And I think he might have got through about five or six songs. People were unhappy, but you know what? I just sat back and I thought, you know, I'm listening to one of the greats. And I think he stopped touring that year. But it was a fantastic, just being in his presence. And also Ray Charles, he came out and he played in The Mission.
Oh, I would have loved to have done that.
Yeah, and people were disappointed. He only did seven numbers, you know, but I can recall the...
I would pay thousands of dollars to see Ray Charles.
And I can recall the concert as if it was yesterday. Every song, the small conversation that he had with us, and you're right, Holly. I just want to toe talk with you. Just sometimes being in their presence, even if you're one of 300, 3,000, or 30,000, you know, just being there. And I don't think they make them like that anymore, eh? They just don't make them like that anymore.
Oh, hang on a minute, bro.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
No, I mean, I think that's the thing. I mean, music obviously is such a huge influence and, you know, directs my whole life. And people who I listen to with that much love, I did the same thing. I've seen Stevie Wonder and I just cried the whole gig. Cat Stevens, another one of my absolute favourites. When I saw him a couple of years ago, just sat there bawling my eyes out. It's just, I mean, I don't care what they do, like just to be in the same room with them is a privilege because they've given so many people so much, you know, beautiful moments, and that's what music can do, and that's why it's an incredible gift.
I've been lucky enough to chase concerts and go to concerts, and I've got a little list at home. Paul McCartney came about 3 or 4 years ago, and you just had to go because you're never going to get to see the Beatles, but you're going to get to see Paul McCartney, who's, you know, one of the great composers of the last century and this century, and you know, Wings and his stuff, you know, that he's done over the last 20 years. But you know, his whole, and it was just a great concert. He played, you know, I think 30 songs from Go to Woe. It was fantastic. But back to you, Holly. Yeah, but back to you, Holly. Bathe in the River is where you got real national prominence. It was a beautiful song. Accompanied by a beautiful movie, Number Two. And early on in terms of a groundbreaker in terms of featuring Pacifica actors in a Pacifica setting, in an urban setting. How did you get involved in that collaboration?
Yeah, well, that's why Bainera was an interesting journey with me because, you know, I'd been working down in Wellington with Trinity and Warren and done some things with Fat Freddy's Drop and another Detroit DJ, Recluse, who was living there at the time. And it was really, you know, like I kind of established this really sort of simmering kind of crowd base. And then basically, and I wasn't going to do any more collaborations because it's like, right, I'm focusing on my stuff, going to do my album. And then, Don McGlashan rang me and I was like, okay, hello. And he was like, you know, do you want to come sing this track? It's just going to be, you know, to the score of this movie. And sort of walked in and sung it a few times. And then, then it became what it was. And it was not what either of us were expecting. And I was trying to release my own music shortly afterwards, and I sort of kind of felt like it was sort of taking the wind out of my sails a little bit. But no, I mean, it was an amazing thing to be a part of, and I'm grateful that it was part of my journey.
A beautiful a beautiful song in its own right. But I just want to say, Holly, when later you sung it in Te Reo, I personally think it just took it up to another level. And I love the original, but I love the original, but I'm really happy with the Te Reo. But
it was a pretty special thing to do. And, you know, because I didn't write the song, but because I've had such a close affinity with it for, you know, a decade, to work with Tweety Waititi, yeah, and to really have this beautiful kōrero around, you know, sort of the true wairoa of the song, you know, and obviously it's not a transliteration, you know, like we really went deep into where we wanted to pull that.
Yeah.
And even with, you know, korokutia, like, you know, being sort of a more of an older Māori language word of, you know, sort of baptism or, you know. So, yeah, I mean, she did an incredible job, but, you know, we went pretty deep to establish that, and just beautiful to understand the language more, moving into that poetic, you know, translation process, and did the same as well with Coming In From The Dark, with Scotty Morrison, and when he did produce that and explain what it meant, it was like, oh, that's way better than my words.
Scotty Morrison everywhere, man, and just such a good soul, eh? And very generous with his time and his knowledge. Such a good dude.
Oh, him and Stacey both. Yeah. I mean, I met them I ran into them in Whangamatara. I didn't realise they had a place down there, because my partner, his mum's lives there. And we ran into them and went round there, and there was, you know, this Pākehā couple that turned up with their tamariki, and Stacey's like, oh, yeah, and just like, they went in and made themselves at home, and we're talking pretty much fluent Māori.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, yeah, they got in touch with us because they were moving down here, and they really wanted to start this journey and raise their kids in Te Reo Māori. So we just said, look, well, let's just hang out. And so a complete stranger. I think she even messaged her on Twitter or something. She's like, oh, okay, we'll come around to the whare and we'll have a hang.
So then
a year or two later, now they're all speaking fluent Te Reo Māori, and these guys are like great mates. And it was just from like, oh, could you possibly help me?
They've done a great job with a whole bunch of people, and just, as I say, very generous in terms of spirit, in terms of time, in terms of sharing their knowledge. Hey, Holly, I want to talk about your album, Coming In From The Dark.
Let's do it.
Yeah, can I just? I think I'm a reasonably articulate person, but I've thought about it on the drive over. How do I share sort of my feel of this album? And you know, we live in a very dark time at the moment with COVID, and you know, we've seen sort of what we've seen over the last week. You obviously started writing it some time ago. Tell me about the formation of it. How you got it together. Do you sort of like write 30 songs, peel it back? How do you construct an album?
with glorious amounts of procrastination, evidently, being 5 years on. No, it's just when I feel ready to write, I'll write, and then, you know, I'll get a collection of songs, and when I think it's ready, I'll consider it. I mean, there's other factors, financially and otherwise, you know, that restricts things, but, I mean, this one came, you know, just sort of over the last 5 years. I mean, the first song, which is the last track on the album, You, nice. I mean, I record, that was one of the first songs I had written. I think that it was even, I wrote that just as Water of Gold was out. I solely can remember because it was when Trump was was running for presidency. Mm. And, you know, and that's what some of the song was about. You know, his immigration laws and just the fact that, you know, these people had built his whole country, and, you know, and also a song about just having to step back from social media and being overwhelmed. The second verse was more about the Syrian refugee crisis, mm-hmm. and also some horrific things that had happened with our tamariki and Aotearoa. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, I felt hopeless being overwhelmed looking at these things every day. So it was sort of, you know, the chorus is kind of the collapse of not being able to cope. But then, yeah, it's moved through several different things. Some of the songs are relationship-based, which I wouldn't normally do, and if I do, not so direct. So that's an interesting aspect, I think, of the album, which is a little bit more relatable. I mean, Damage Done. Oh, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, because they're really interesting, You. I got the vibe, and I read the lyrics, and you can tell that there's some sort of global influences that have impacted and that you've put weaved into the lyrics. But there's also a lot of personal stuff there. You talked about social media, but I just listened to Billy, and I just found it haunting. I didn't know the backstory about it, and I tweeted you and said, I really love the song, and what's the backstory? And you shared it with me, and I wonder whether you'd share it with the listeners tonight, because it's just a fantastic song, whanau, from Holly Smith's album Coming In From the Dark, track called
Thank
Billy.
You, Shane. Yeah, well, so Billy was my first love. We were together for a couple of years, sort of maybe 15, 16 or something, 16, 17. He was a little bit older than me. We I was, his family is just a massive part of my life. I absolutely adore his parents. We see each other all the time. And his siblings were all close ages with myself. He has two other brothers and a sister. So I'm in touch with his two brothers mainly, but his sister also. But we always stayed in touch, and Billy sort of, was semi-wayward and did his own thing, but, would always sort of touch base here and there. Kind of found out that his son, Marley, oh, sorry, I shouldn't say his name, but his son, who was only 2 or 3 years old, was killed in an accident at home. And, he has other children and all that kind of thing. But I think, he kind of reached out to me at that point, which is, it was a bit odd, but I think it was just that kind of comfort of, that knowing. So we sort of worked our way, I helped him work his way through that for a while. And then very shortly afterwards, he got diagnosed with an incredibly rare form of lymphoma. And I've been through that journey before with my best friend Helena, who passed away from breast cancer several years ago now, which is weird to say.
Time flies, eh?
That's bizarre. Mm. So I was trying to help just with his whānau, and, because I'd experienced it before and I felt comfortable being there. And, he went, sort of was up and down, but it overcame him, and he passed away at home quite comfortably.
Well, I want to tell you, Holly, you've done...
Not very long afterwards, yeah. And then, I sort of turned up without knowing he had passed away. He passed away about 4 or 5 in the morning, and I was always going around after my yoga, and turned up and I was like, okay, sweet, so is he okay today? What's happening? And he was not. And so I went in and lay with him for a few hours and got him dressed and clean, because I'm quite good with that now. And I went home and just felt the urge to write. And that song literally was one of the ones that came in a way that it wrote itself as it happened, and it was probably written within about 5 minutes.
That's really interesting. I love music, and I love musicians, and I'm a huge Springsteen fan, and some of the greatest songs that people write can just come to them within 4 or 5 minutes, and then they can labour over another song for years.
Yep. Mm. Yep, that's the way it rolls. I mean, there's only been a few songs in my career, but in my journey that I've written that have happened like that. And, I wanted to have that ready for his funeral. Not that I would be able to perform it, but I recorded a little version for him. That was just, I wanted to give back. But that's just what it felt like. It felt like he needed to go, and it just, there was too much going on for him to focus on reality and life, and he had to just go look after his boy, So that's the comfort that, that brings me with that song. So,
yep. Holly, did you just wrapping up, because it's been a wonderful corduroy, this type of corduroy, and that we could talk all night. But Holly, did you think about delaying in the time of COVID? Because that's often how people will They'll release an album and their tour, because recorded music doesn't sell as well as it used to, and the royalties, particularly if it goes to Spotify, and that's how I listen to most of my music. You know, your cut is minimal. When you get a chance, will you take the album live, and in what form?
Yeah, well, we did have the tour planned for the 39th of October, and then we moved it to the 18th of November, and now we've just announced this week that we'll move to the 9th of February, and we have another contingency up our sleeves too, because my team is incredible. But, yeah, I mean, it just stays fluid at this point. I mean, we just have to kind of accept, you know, what is. I mean, absolutely no one knows what's going to happen at all. So, you know, I mean, the tickets are all on sale.
Yep.
And the venues and cities don't change, and you can turn up to whatever show with the tickets. It's just, yeah, it's just the fluidity of dates and when we can all do it safely and within the restrictions. And, yeah, so it's been hard, like, releasing the album after 5 years and putting so much work into it. You know, it's definitely felt reasonably anticlimactic not to be able to take it on the road and celebrate with my family and
we'll get there.
Even
we'll get there.
See them or hug them.
I'm looking forward to going. Yeah, I'm looking forward to going. And you got my 13-year-old, who's a big Billie Eilish fan. I really tried to get her to listen to Aotearoa music. She loves your album. So you've got another fan, and we're going to bring her along. Hey Holly, it's been my absolute pleasure having you on, having a kōrero for 40-odd minutes with the whānau out there in Wātea land. I really appreciate it, particularly on a Friday night. And I just want to say again, Holly, congratulations on what I think is a fantastic album. And from a personal perspective, and I'm not just saying this because you're my guest tonight, but from a personal perspective, we've produced some very good music in Aotearoa in 2021 and have a tough time. But I just want to say, whānau, get out and get that album. You can listen to it on Spotify and lots of other means. It's a great read. So Holly Smith,